I think we'll get started. Good evening to everybody. I'm Christine Chinkin, Professor of International Law here at the LSE, and it's my very great pleasure and privilege to be chairing tonight's lecture, which is Reducing Poverty, How Human Rights Can Help. The lecture is hosted by the LSE's Centre for the Study of Human Rights, and it's part of the public outreach activities of the Centre for Human Rights. Now, as probably everybody here knows, in December 1995, the United Nations General Assembly proclaimed the first United Nations decade for the eradication of poverty. 1996, the following year, the Assembly followed this up and declared that eradicating poverty is an ethical, social, political, and economic imperative of humankind. Again, following it up at the midpoint, as the first of the Millennium Development Goals, the eradication of extreme poverty was spelled out, and the underlying notion there was reducing the proportion of people living on less than a dollar a day to half the 1990 level by 2015, and halving the proportion of people who suffer from hunger between 1990 and 2015. Of course, in this last couple of weeks within this country, there's been a great deal of attention to the whole issue of poverty. We've had George Brown's so-called Marshall Plan for the developing world, principally Africa, in which, again, the notion is to seek to combine massively increased aid, easier trade rules, and debt cancellation for the poorest countries, essentially, again, to eradicate poverty. And even more so, of course, equally, in the last few weeks, we've seen how suddenly, out of nothing, essentially, people can be reduced to the most extreme circumstances, lose their livelihoods, be reduced to extreme poverty by the devastating forces of nature, which have destroyed communities, families, lives, and, of course, property, livelihoods across Asia. So all of this makes it a highly appropriate moment for a public lecture on poverty eradication. But also, of course, poverty eradication is most frequently presented through the lenses of social policy, economic growth, sustainable development, human needs, trade, and adjustment. Our speaker tonight is taking a very different approach and addressing the subject through the lens of human rights, and so the role of human rights through to reducing poverty. And I think that nobody is better qualified to do this than Pierre Cerny. Mr. Cerny has had a very long and prestigious career in the fields of international development and human rights. He has written many published articles in both of these areas. He's returning to one of his alma maters as he holds an MSc in public administration and public policy from the LSE. He has a doctorate in political science from the Carleton University in Ottawa. And since 2001, he's been Assistant Director General for Social Sciences and Human Sciences, Ethics and Human Rights at UNESCO in Paris. There, he has been responsible for the development, execution, and evaluation of many programs and projects, including those on human rights, development, gender and women's rights, racism and discrimination, and poverty and human rights. Prior to that time, Mr. Cerny was Secretary General of Amnesty International for nearly a decade, and I notice there are many of his former colleagues who are in the audience. At Amnesty International, Mr. Cerny campaigned extensively to raise human rights concerns worldwide and to strengthen the human rights movement. He headed Amnesty International's delegations to many global summit meetings, including the World Conference on Human Rights in Vienna in 1993 and the Fourth World Conference on Women in Beijing in 1995. He also headed Amnesty International's campaign to mark the 50th anniversary of the Universal Declaration on threats to defenders of human rights. Those are just very much few of a sort of picked out moments of Mr. Cerny's highly prestigious career in these areas. And we are delighted to have you here tonight to talk about poverty eradication and human rights.
Thank you very much, Christine. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Good evening, dear friends. Good evening, all comrades. Good evening, students. I am very honored to have been invited by the center to give this public lecture, and very honored to follow on the steps of such luminaries as Noam Chomsky or Mary Robinson, Irene Khan. So for me, it is a great honor to be in the same group of people. I love name dropping, you know, and Desmond Tutu tells the story of this Englishman who is always engaged in name dropping, to the extent that one of his best friends was so irritated that he told him, "But John, why is it that you are always dropping names? What is the problem with it?" And he said, "Well, it's strange that you say that. Last week I was at Buckingham Palace and the Queen made the same remark." All right, so this is to say really that it is a great honor for me to be here tonight and to have a conversation with you on the issue of poverty and human rights. Now, most of what I'm going to say are my personal opinion. So if there is any journalist in the room, do not write that the Assistant Director General of UNESCO said this or that. So I will separate my remarks into two parts. First, I will speak as an international civil servant, and I will give you the party line. And then I will put my hat of international civil servant. You see, I didn't wear a tie today. And I will give you my own views of what I think UNESCO should do and the human rights movement should do if we want to address seriously the issue of poverty. Now, in 1994, when the winners of the Second World War instituted the UN, they decided to go a step further and to establish UNESCO, believing that agreements between peoples could only be sustained if they were founded on the intellectual and moral solidarity of humankind. They decided to create an institution to embody such foundation, and they published the Constitution of UNESCO on the 16th of November 1945 in London. The ambition was huge, but necessity dictated it. It is as urgent today. The great and terrible war that just ended in 1944-45 had shown how much it costs humanity when the values of human dignity, justice, and peace are set aside. Further, at that time, the era of independences that started heralded a world where diversity will impose itself. What was needed was to value diversity and to build on it, the future of peaceful relations between people. Over the six decades, UNESCO has entrenched concepts such as world heritage, has accompanied and guided the most formidable expansion in education ever known to the world, has advocated the ethics of sharing and social responsibility in the field of scientific and technological development, has guaranteed the conditions of freedom and quality of information which constitute the basis for the development of knowledge societies. The organization has continuously intervened in the debate on social transformations and human rights. Today, dangerous evolutions are bringing back the same threats of terrible violence because of the weakening of the democratic ideal of dignity, equality, respect for the human being. The one threat that dwarfs all the others, in my humble view, is the persistence and increase of poverty and extreme poverty. UNESCO, alongside the other agencies in the United Nations system, is firmly engaged through various activities in pushing and helping governments and societies reach the targets set by the Millennium Development Goals. What I would like here in this talk now is to share with you my personal views on the issue of poverty and the direction we should look at in combating it. Now, I've been arguing this for the past 3 years and pushing for a strong human right foundation for our work on poverty eradication. So some of you may have heard that speech already, or they may have read it, but I believe in the virtue and in the power of repetition. Desmond Tutu tells the story of this physics professor, I think, in London, who has been delivering the same lecture over and over and over again. And one day he was in his car with his driver going to deliver again exactly the same lecture. And he told his driver, "But you must be really tired of hearing me saying the same thing." The driver said, "Yes, and actually I know your speech by heart." He says, "No, come on, this is physics." And the driver said, "Well, just dare me." He said, "Okay, go ahead." And the driver gave him the total speech, including the anecdotes, the jokes, everything. He said, "This is unbelievable. You know what we should do today? Since I'm sick and tired of delivering the same speech, we will switch places. I will pretend I'm the driver, and you will pretend you are the professor of physics." Fine. So they went to the conference, and the driver gave the speech. Impeccable speech. But he knew the speech so well that he finished 10 minutes before time. So therefore, the chair said, "Well, we have time for questions." And the first question, as usual, is a convoluted, complicated question. And then the driver said, "Well, that's it. I mean, this is so easy. Even my driver sitting in the back of the room can answer that question." So I think that I'll be able to handle questions at the end of the session. And in any case, I do not have a driver. So be assured that we'll have time for discussion. So my view is simple and it is straightforward. It is a simple proposal. Poverty will only cease when it is recognized as a violation of human rights and as such abolished. I repeat, poverty will only cease when it is recognized as a violation of human rights and as such abolished. So this is my proposition. Now, one should be aware of the striking feature of our civilization as it globalizes around the aspiration to unprecedented prosperity. It is the persistence and even increase of poverty. It is an overwhelming fact. Poverty affects half the world population. It is spreading. The vast majority of the 2 to 3 thousand million people who will be added to the world population before the end of the century will be exposed to poverty. It is putting alarming pressure on the environment and on global equilibrium, and the figures are apocalyptic. 8 million children die each year because of poverty. 150 million children under the age of 5 suffer from extreme malnutrition. 100 million children live in the streets. Every 3 seconds, a child somewhere is killed because of poverty. And our world puts up with it. And let us keep in mind that the resources exist to eradicate poverty today, not in 2015, but today. Now, one child that dies because of poverty every 3 seconds It's like a jumbo jet full of children which crashes every 15 minutes. A jumbo jet full of children crashing every 15 minutes. Now, whenever a plane crashes, there is investigation, we go through technical review, et cetera, to make sure that no plane will crash again. It is a big scandal, it is on the news, it is on television, et cetera, et cetera. Here, the equivalent of one child dying because of poverty every 3 seconds is a jumbo jet every 15 minutes that crashes full of children, which is one tsunami a week, exclusively taking children. One tsunami a week. When in 1994, 800,000 corpses of Tutsi and opposition Hutu were victims of genocide in Rwanda, and when they were carried on rivers of blood through the country of 1,000 hills, the world held its breath. We all felt guilty. We wished that action had been taken to prevent it. We all said, once again, never again. The United Nations set up an international tribunal to establish the truce and to hand down justice. We said, we cannot bring back the dead, but the guilty shall pay. International law will prevail. Morality is safe. But what about the 8 million children who die each year from poverty-related diseases? We are well aware of these figures, and they are probably underestimated. We will not be taken by surprise. And again, and furthermore, we could prevent the slaughter with means that in the final analysis are fairly limited. What then, I ask, is the basis of the ethical double standards which leads us to accept the poverty manufactured by our society, even though it kills more surely and methodically than machetes and militias? Is there a single moral or ethical justification for the central contradiction between the equality proclaimed in the granting of rights and growing inequality in access to life-giving resources? To address this question is essential for the preservation of our own humanity. The rush of solidarity that the world has witnessed over the past few weeks since the violent tragedy that befell coastlines of the Indian Ocean is both heartening and depressing. The generosity is reassuring as it shows that there is global community, world solidarity, universal conscience that crosses over boundaries of color, religion, nationality, and shows that people can wake up and manifest themselves in times of mourning and misery. And yet, this enthusiasm is also saddening in that it shows how ignorant the world is about the daily struggle of the poorest people. Because of its tremendous size, the catastrophe affected all countries, rich and poor alike, large and small, but there are people who paradoxically live through a silent human tragedy every day. It is a tragedy of an even greater scale, but one that the world ignores or to which it is indifferent. Every year, in the country around the Bay of Bengal, India, the Maldives, Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, Myanmar, Thailand, Malaysia, Indonesia, several million people, mostly children, die simply because they have no safe drinking water, and so they drink unclean water. Poverty silently ravages and kills, creating a human catastrophe that moves no one. Another reason this burst of solidarity is depressing is that people would not have shown such solidarities if lives had not been lost, especially lives of 10,000 Western tourists. In this era of scientific and technological development, man can tame nature, foresee its vagaries, and even save lives. the technology has been available. A tsunami measure, a control tool for the protection of coastal areas known for almost half a century. UNESCO was the agency that set up in 1965 the tsunami alert and response in the Pacific Ocean. When 2 years ago, we proposed the same alert system to the member states for the Indian Ocean, the answer was, we have no money. Now, should not scientific progress be at the service of everyone when human lives are at stake? And when we think back a year to the earthquake in Bam, in Iran, on 26 December 2003, it measured 6.8 on the Richter scale, and more than 30,000 people were killed. 3 months later, 3 months earlier, on 26 September 2003, an even more violent tremor, 8 on the Richter scale, on Hokkaido Island in Japan, killed no one. Each year, catastrophes affect around 211 million people, of whom two-thirds live in countries of the South where poverty adds to their vulnerability. The human tragedy of the Indian Ocean brings us back to the eternal question of priorities and the primacy of values. The only priority cannot and must not be other than that of the preservation and respect for human life. It is a matter of the right to life from the moral as well as ethical and legal perspective. It would seem, however, that the famous standards of decency are changing. Thus, the international community has set as a priority for the Millennium Development Goals, the first of which is eradicate extreme poverty and hunger. The quantitative target by which such success in poverty eradication will be measured is to reduce by half in 10 years the percentage of people living in extreme poverty, meaning that if we are successful, by 2015, instead of 8 million children dying every year, it will be only 4 million children dying every year. This approach, however laudable in itself, does not exhaust the issue. For one thing, the intended target will not easily be reached, but even if it were successfully achieved, the basic question will remain untouched. Can persistent poverty be tolerated at all, in a word of plenty? This problem has to be tackled from another angle. As long as we consider poverty as a quantitative natural deficit to be made up, the political will to reduce it will not be energized. Poverty will only cease when it is recognized as a violation of human rights and as such abolished. And this is why, and this is how. When poverty is defined in relative terms, it is at once infinite and incurable. We are forced at the same time to consent to it indefinitely and to exhaust in vain unending resources in seeking to reduce it. This relativistic approach can only determine an arbitrary poverty line, which is adopted as an artificial horizon. But such a bogus horizon remains unbearable. What do $1 or $2 a day mean? And above all, what right do we have to make do with such a figure? For poverty is not a fate to be alleviated by international charity or aid, nor does poverty reflect poor people's lack of self-reliance or their inability to compete in a free-for-all of supposedly equal opportunities. Poverty does not persist solely because of incompetent, corrupt governments that are insensitive to the fate of their population. No, fundamentally, poverty is not a standard of living or even certain kinds of living condition. It is at once the cause and the effect of the total or partial denial of human rights. The issue, therefore, is to bring poverty into the domain of rights and to pose the question along the following lines. What does the law say, and what could the law say with regard to poverty, and what should the law say with regard to poverty? What are the rights of the poor person? National, international rights. Who has an obligation to respect, protect, fulfill the rights of the poor people? Where does charity end and responsibility begin? Rights have historically been defined as a protection against threats. Different modern human rights theories based on positive law provide different points of view from which to understand poverty through rights. My own approach is founded on Professor Edmund Kahn's theory of justice. While Kahn's theory no longer has the influence it once enjoyed, it has a particular appeal to human rights activists. Kahn asserts that although there may be universal a priori truths concerning justice from which rights or norms may be deduced, it is better to approach justice from its negative rather than its affirmative side. In other words, it is much easier to identify injustice. Furthermore, says Kahn, where justice is thought of in the customary manner as an ideal mode or condition, for example, roles, the human response will be contemplative and contemplation bakes no loaves. But the response to a real or imagined instance of injustice is alive with movement and warmth, producing outrage and anger. Therefore, he concludes, justice is the active process of remedying or preventing what arouses the sense of injustice. An examination of the instances which will be considered injustice thereby allows a positive formulation of justice. This concept of the need to right wrong has the capacity to produce action. The practical starting point may well be the strongly felt response to words which move one with emotional force and practical urgency to press for the satisfaction or repair of some need, deprivation, threat, or insecurity. Such an approach, obviously, will find a response in human rights advocates anxious to focus public attention on the injustice of the wide variety of egregious human rights abuses which remain prevalent. This is the philosophical foundation for my claim of poverty as a human rights violation. Of the five families of rights, civil, political, cultural, economic, and social, proclaimed by the Universal Declaration of Human Rights as inherent to the human dignity of all, poverty violates systematically most of them. Now, I'm missing one page. Okay. I should ask my driver. Okay. So the taking economic measures and deploying poverty reduction strategies under the guidance, usual guidance of the World Bank, will not eradicate poverty. Maybe it will reduce poverty, because if you look at the language in the documents of the UN or of the World Bank, we're talking about reducing poverty, as if we had a target in combating torture of reducing torture, as opposed to eliminating torture or to eradicating torture. Now, when poverty is declared to be abolished, as it should with regard to its status as a massive, systematic, and continuous violation of human rights, its persistence will not be any longer a regrettable feature of the nature of things. It would become a denial of justice, and the burden of the proof will shift. The poor, once they have been recognized as the injured party, would acquire a right to reparation from which governments, the international community, and ultimately each citizen will be jointly liable. A strong interest would thus be established in eliminating, as a matter of urgency, the grounds of liability which might be expected to unleash much stronger forces than compassion, charity, or even concern for one's own security are likely to mobilize for the benefit of others. By endowing the poor with rights, by recognizing their rights, the abolition of poverty would obviously not cause poverty to disappear overnight. It would, however, create the conditions for the cause of poverty to be enshrined as the highest of priorities and as the common interest of all, not just as a secondary concern for the enlightened or merely charitable. No more than the abolition of slavery caused the crime to vanish, no more than the abolition of domestic violence or genocide have eliminated such violations of the human conscience, the legal abolition of poverty will not then make poverty disappear, but it will place poverty on the conscience of humankind at the same level as those past injustices, the present survival of which challenges us, shocks us, and calls us into action. The principle of justice thus implemented and the force of law mobilized in its service are of enormous power. This, after all, is how slavery, colonialism, and apartheid were ended. But while slavery and apartheid were actively struggled against, poverty dehumanizes half of the planet to a chorus of utter indifference. It is undoubtedly the most acute moral question of the new century to understand how such massive and systematic violations day in, day out do not trouble the consciousness of the good people who look down upon them. While equality of rights is proclaimed, growing inequalities in the distribution of goods persist and are entrenched by unjust economic and social policies at national and global level. To deal with poverty as a violation of human rights means going beyond the idea of international justice, which is concerned with relations between states and nations, towards the creation of global justice, which applies to relation between human beings living in a global society and enjoying absolute and inalienable rights, such as the right to life, that are guaranteed by the international community. Such rights do not belong to the citizens of states, but universally to human beings as such, for whom they are the necessary condition of life on the planet. The obligation to denounce violations and to ensure respect, protection, and effective enjoyment of rights is incumbent on all, without distinction of race, country, or creed. The principle of global justice thus establishes the conditions for a fairer distribution of the planet's resources between its inhabitants in light of certain absolute rights. Let us remember that, morally speaking, the right to property is not absolute. It follows that territorial sovereignty, which entails ownership of natural resources, cannot qualify as an absolute right, such as the right to life elsewhere. What we must note is that nearly 3 billion people receive only about 1.2% of world income, while 1 billion people in the rich countries receive 80%. An annual income transfer of 1% from one group to the other will suffice to eliminate extreme poverty. In fact, the transfer continues to operate in the opposite direction, despite effort towards debt reduction and development aid. At the end of the day, there is a simple choice, not between a pragmatic approach based on aid granted by the rich to the poor and the alternative sketched here. The real choice is between the abolition of poverty and the only other way for the poor to obtain rights, which is for them to take them by force. Needless to say, the latter solution usually causes misery for all, social strife, rampant crime, mass uncontrolled migration, smuggling and trafficking are the only things to flourish. But what moral basis do we have to demand moral behavior from people to whom we deny any opportunity to live a healthy life? What right have we to demand that they respect our rights? The somber option will become increasingly likely if nothing is done, or too little, as tends to be the case with pragmatism, however deserving. The option thus reduced to a single choice, which is the one, the only one compatible with the categorical imperative to respect human rights, to abolish poverty in order to eradicate it, and to draw from this principle all the consequences that free acceptance of it implies. No great program will ensure the eradication of poverty. Its proclaimed abolition must first create rights and obligations, and thereby mobilize the true forces that can correct the state of a world plagued by poverty. By simply setting an effective and binding priority, abolition changes the ground rules and contributes to the creation of a new world. Such is the price to pay to give globalization a human face. Such is also the greatest opportunity for sustainable development that we can hope to grasp. What are the NGOs? What are the implications for NGO activity? First, I would suggest that it is imperative to develop strategies that give tangible significance to the principles of indivisibility and interdependence of human rights. The unfortunate historical separation of human rights into civil, political on the one hand, economic, social, and cultural on the other has tended to entrench the view that poverty was beyond the scope of human rights NGO and to farm out poverty to market forces, development processes, and development NGOs. Campaigns for ratification of international treaties must promote treaties on social, economic, and cultural rights. National legislation must be amended accordingly, and violation of such rights must be actionable. Furthermore, in the field, research techniques must be deployed to monitor the violations suffered by victims, fulfillment of their obligations by the states and international actors, and reparation for injured parties. Ultimately, the issue is to mobilize public opinion for a universal justice that is within our grasp. Its emergence has been lengthy, very lengthy. From the Universal Declaration of Human Rights to the Rome Conference that established the International Criminal Court, the emergence of universal justice has been defiled by acts of barbarity that have grossly infringed human dignity. Now, however, the legal instruments are there, and if they are not there, they can be developed. And step by step, experiments and initiatives give hope. It remains to energize political will by unceasing mobilization, true thinking, the contribution of experts, and support for victims and their families. What promises does such a global justice bear? Let me quote Nobel laureate José Saramago from Portugal. He said, "Were such justice to exist, there would be no longer a single human being dying of hunger or of diseases that are curable for some but not for others. Were such justice to exist, life would no longer be, for half of humanity, the dreadful sentence it has hitherto been. And for such justice, we already have a practical code that has been laid down for 50 years in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, a declaration that might profitably replace, as far as rightness of principles and clarity of objectives are concerned, the manifestos of all the political parties of the world." What role can UNESCO play in all this? First of all, I want to say that the United Nations does not have the monopoly on poverty eradication and that it is not its role. It is governments, like here in the UK, who must undertake this effort. The United Nations system is a facilitator for international cooperation and a partner for countries when drawing up such national plans, as well as helping with capacity building for countries, helping build the capacity of professionals so that governments and civil society in their preventive role can take the necessary follow-up action. In response to the reforms introduced by the United Nations Secretary General to mainstream human rights in all programs and projects, and in evaluating action and results by their impact on human rights, each of the UN specialized agencies has got down to the task falling within its mandate. The FAO, World Food Organization, today calls for the enforcement of the right to food. The WHO, the right to health. UNESCO, the right to education, and so on. We should perhaps note that since the Vienna Declaration at the 1993 World Conference on Human Rights, which stated that poverty is a denial of human dignity, there has been one declaration after another by different bodies, such as the United Nations General Assembly in 2000 to qualify poverty as a violation of human dignity and a denial of human rights. In UNESCO, we are supporting research and studies on different subjects which tackle all aspects of the issue. We are involving philosophers, sociologists, political scientists, economists, legal experts in all aspects of poverty and human rights so that their combined efforts can converge within one conceptual framework and give content to what is now, up to now, only a political declaration that poverty violates human dignity and denies people their rights. Encouraging states from the South to take part in international debate on poverty and human rights and proposing subjects for reflections such as alternative policies based on a human rights strategy. This is UNESCO's contribution to the achievement of this crucial Millennium Development Goal, the one on which all others ultimately depend. In overcoming the threats that weigh so heavily on its future, the world has the lever that Archimedes demanded. It lacks only the fulcrum to decide to abolish poverty and thereby to ban all acts that create or maintain it will provide precisely that fulcrum. I thank you for your patience.
Thank you very much for a most eloquent exposition of what is essentially a very simple idea. I'm sure there are many questions. Mr. Sane has agreed to answer them himself and not look to the driver at the back of the room to answer them. So, and we've got some time to do so. So throw the floor open. Could speakers, there'll be roving mics, could speakers please identify themselves and also attempt to present a question fairly briefly to give more time for further exchanges among other people.
Thank you very much. I'm Ralph Wilde from the Law Department at LSE. Thank you very much for an inspirational talk of the conceptual basis for arguing for an obligation, a human rights obligation, to eradicate poverty, and an obligation that should operate like the obligation not to commit torture. That's to say, something that shouldn't be achieved partially, but should come into operation instantly. What I wondered, though, was how that fitted in within the legal framework of international law, where the civil and political rights are conceived differently from economic, social, and cultural rights. The obligation not to commit torture is an instant one. States don't have any leeway to implement that obligation partially or over time, whereas, of course, the obligation to abolish poverty, even if it can be understood as an obligation to abolish it completely, only operates progressively. That's to say, states have a certain amount of leeway in that their obligation to implement it is contingent on the resources they have available. I wonder whether you thought that was an adequate formulation, a legal formulation, in order to implement your broader political objective.
I suggest we take three or four, and then rather than try and get some sort of more different issues, different approaches. At the back.
Following on from that question, Raymond Perrier, a human rights student here and a Jesuit. Following on from that question, how do we deal with situations where states, far from progressively seeking to eradicate poverty, have indeed increased poverty? And to put a specific slant on that, why shouldn't the international community intervene in Zimbabwe to impose regime change there on a president who has increased poverty when resources are available to prevent that country being in increasing state of poverty?
My name's Ellie. Right. What's the what would you say is the responsibility and the obligation of the richer countries, the developed countries that you talked about, to receive 80% of, I guess, global income? And what is the their governments, and what is the responsibility of their citizens to reduce poverty and enhance human rights?
Hello, my name is Caroline Hartnell from Alliance Magazine. I wondered if the human rights framework you've put forward has anything to say about the level of poverty, because it's something that always strikes me about the Millennium Development Goals. I mean, you comment it's strange that we'll be happy if we've eliminated half the poverty and there's still 4 million children dying each year. But it also strikes me, will we be happy if we've made this 1% transfer? And the rest of the world, the poor world, are now living in conditions that none of us would contemplate or see as anything less than totally unacceptable. You know, where we're struggling with our second car and third holiday. And are we then happy that they've got, you know, these other people have enough food, and they've now got a doctor within 2 miles walk, and so on? So what, you know, what is there? I don't know what the human rights perspective has to say about that sort of relative poverty and that very meager transfer that we're talking about.
Yes, well, on the first question, human rights law, international human rights law is dynamic. It is always in development. The fact that today you have one covenant that is supposed to be implemented immediately, and the other one for which the ambition is progressive realization, doesn't mean that the law is correct. On both sets of rights, you have positive duties and negative duties. On both sets of rights, you need resources. You cannot eradicate torture unless you invest in setting up a criminal justice system, having decent prisons, training prison guards, et cetera, et cetera. All of that takes investment. So the issue of resources, when you put that in the context of the international obligation to cooperate, that is, we shouldn't look at human rights just within the confine of one nation state. We should look at it globally. If they are universal, the obligations are universal. So the government here has responsibility to ensure, like somebody was asking about Zimbabwe, has obligation to ensure that nobody is tortured in Zimbabwe. But similarly, has obligation to ensure that no child in Zimbabwe goes hungry. Because for a child to go hungry and not having a decent meal for 1, 2, 3 days, it's as bad as somebody being tortured, I mean, morally. So my argument is that the law has evolved. The international covenant didn't take properly account of the threats on women and responded by developing a new convention on women, same with children, because usually the rights are in response to perceived threats. The abolition or the right not to be enslaved came as a response to slavery. Convention on torture was a response to a practice that was not codified internationally. So if poverty is recognized as a massive injustice, then if you have the necessary mobilization, et cetera, then lawyers will be called in to draft whatever adjustment is needed to the law. So the covenants are not Bible. They were developed in 1966, and because of, well, they were finalized in 1966, and because of Cold War, etc., well, all this story that we know, social, economic, and cultural rights were not given the same importance. So today you have within the UN system a whole sophisticated machinery to deal with civil and political rights, but the equivalent in social, economic, and cultural rights does not exist. It is underdeveloped. It is only now that the UN is really starting to catch up. The protocol, the additional protocol, but there are also discussion in the UN commission, subcommission, on whether we need a declaration on human rights and extreme poverty. Some argue yes, others say what exists already in terms of obligations of states in social, economic, and cultural rights should be sufficient if it was enacted at the national level and acted upon. So the existing international law, I don't know whether it provides the answer or not. I'm not a lawyer. We can ask lawyers. Actually, we are going to organize an international seminar here in...
which the questioner is actually
going to
speak.
That's right. And we'll bring lawyers from all persuasion to, you know, to explore the issue and tell us what's the direction in the legal field in order to use the law as a weapon in favor of the poor. But, you know, you have two lawyers, you have two different views. You know, like they say in the U.S., when you go to court as a lawyer, if the facts are against you, argue the law. If the law is against you, argue the facts. If both facts and law are against you, just argue. Now, what happens when human rights are violated, and should government use force in order to change the situation in a given country in order to promote human rights, i.e., should regime change happen by one way or the other, use of force or sanctions, etc., etc. Personally, as a human rights activist, I don't believe that the end justifies the means. I believe that the means should be in accordance with the ends. I don't believe that you can impose human rights by force. I don't believe that you can impose human rights from outside. I believe that it is possible to put pressure on governments to change their ways. And I'm always suspicious of governments who say they are waging a war or they are promoting regime change in order to protect human rights, because we can see the regimes in the world. I'm not going to compare Mugabe with other regimes. We see the regimes in the world. When you read the annual report of Amnesty International, you have maybe, I don't know, 120, 140, 150 countries. Okay? So I think human rights requires equal treatment. How are you going to end the death penalty in the United States? Are you going to send the Gurkha from here to go and stop that shame that the death penalty constitutes? So I think that there is always the risk of political manipulation of human rights, of justifying actions for human rights reason and motivations of governments. I mean, so that is my response for Zimbabwe. Individual responsibility, yes. I mean, I guess we're all the keepers of our brothers and sisters. Human rights and the human rights scenario, the human rights situation in the world can only change and has only changed when people get mobilized around the world to change things. It is the mobilization of civil society organizations, NGOs, church groups, trade unions that brought about the Convention Against Torture. Governments react to demands. If people are not demanding anything, then they will not react to it. Even take the tsunami. I mean, the reaction to the tsunami was highly influenced by the media coverage. I mean, day in, day out, you were bombarded with picture. Every other hour, you see on television the tsunami. Why were the Western media so interested with the tsunami, given the number of tsunami that kills people every day? It's because you had 10,000 Western tourists there. And then once people are influenced by the media and you have this public reaction, then governments have to follow and to, you know, follow the sense of public opinion and react positively in order to show compassion. And I think for human rights, it's the same thing. I mean, we'll only make a significant dent on poverty once you have the kind of mobilization I saw in this country when I lived here, all the marches against apartheid. Hundreds of thousands of people in the streets of London at Trafalgar Square in front of the South African Embassy demanding the end of apartheid now, not in 15 years, immediately the end of apartheid. So you will only have a response from the international political system once you have these kinds of mobilization. And it is this kind of mobilization that brings changes to the human rights law. The changes will not be brought about by just lawyers. Lawyers will respond to this call and make whatever adjustment is necessary to the law. So individual responsibility, that's the individual responsibility. Now, the question of, 1%, that was just to show that, because, you see, the World Bank defines extreme poverty. They make a difference between extreme poverty and poverty. Extreme poverty is $1 a day, and poverty is extreme poverty is $1 a day, which is 50p, is it? Yeah. And poverty is $2 a day, which is £1 a day. And they say that if you make more than $2 a day, then you are not poor anymore. If you make more than $1 a day, you are not extremely poor anymore. Now, if you make $3 a day, what does that make you? I mean, they have not defined it yet. So even if we follow the calculation of the World Bank, etc., knowing that the figures are probably underestimated, so if we use the logic and the calculation, the statistics of the World Bank, it shows that it is possible to eliminate, using the World Bank definitions, extreme poverty immediately, because it would take 1% of the transfer. So even using the jargon of those institutions, it is possible today, not in 10 years' time. So it is just to show that elimination of poverty is not a question of resources. The resources are available. It is not a question of science. We have the knowledge. We have the know-how. We can eliminate it immediately. And it is just a question of political will. And how do you energize political will? Well, it's you take to the street and you use your voting card. Again, please, I am speaking in my personal capacity. Okay. So if you want an answer from UNESCO, then you should ask me, what is UNESCO thinking or doing of that? If you don't, then I will assume you are asking me in my personal capacity. So let's make that very clear, especially if there are journalists in the room. Okay?
Hello, John O'Dowd from University College Dublin. It just struck me as you were talking, the international human rights we have in the civil and political sphere, you know, freedom of expression, etc., and the whole way of organizing democratic systems of government, historically a lot of that is determined by political struggles in France, in Britain, the United States in the 17th through the 19th centuries, and we have that kind of conceptual legacy. Well, if you look at what's happening today in places like India, Sri Lanka, Venezuela, other parts of Latin America, Brazil, for instance, you have courts, you have lawyers, but you have NGOs as well, political forces, social movements, who are actually trying to put into practice the idea that poverty is a human rights issue, and they're building up a kind of social technical know-how and capacity. And I would just wonder, do you think that in translating this to the level of a global abolition of poverty and a global concept of international justice, that in the same way that the content of civil and political rights reflects those particular cultural circumstances in France and the United States and Britain, that in 100 years' time we'll see that it's these places, the places with extreme poverty and, you know, an attempt to deal with it in human rights terms that have actually contributed to what are all our international human rights. In other words, the poor of the world, the vast majority of those societies where there's actually an attempt to bring a human rights solution to bear will be the places where the global standards for the whole of human society are ultimately developed.
Yes, and I think it is the case now. That's where the standards are being developed and are being tested. Now, of course, in 100 years' time, most of the poor people would have died. That would have solved the problem. But we need it now. But it is true in places like South Africa, in places like India, in places like Brazil, Colombia, et cetera, where you have social, economic, and cultural rights entrenched in the constitution, where courts are making decisions regarding violation of those rights. I think it is from those places that the advances would come, because those are the places of struggle. Those are the places of greatest inequality in the world, and also the places where you have very vibrant organizations in civil society that are dedicated to fighting for the rights of the poor. So I believe that it will come from there.
Hi, my name is Sambaya. I quite liked say your idea of the motivation has to come within the community, and then the government has to be motivated. When I come from India, in India we have wonderful constitution, and then the constitution doesn't discriminate people on the basis of race, caste, community. Yet, we have a community, Dalit community, untouchable community, who are 160 million people. And still, though we have a political will or the people are motivated, yet people are discriminated because they are untouchables. Theoretically, it would be an interesting question in the sense politically, there is a political will, political motivation, and constitutional has provided the rights. But things are not happening. Dalits are most human rights within Dalit community is most violated. So can we think beyond these motivation within the community or motivation, a political motivation? Can we offer beyond this?
Yeah, okay.
Hi. I guess I'll stay seated. I was wondering what you would say to those, particularly some who tend to be the richest in the Western countries, who claim that their right to property is being violated by demanding that they donate part of their resources or that their governments are going to give away some of their tax money to these impoverished countries.
Hello, I'm Zaza Curran from the Overseas Development Institute. Something that comes to mind a bit whenever we talk about this is that I feel a bit that the human rights community and the development community work in parallel, and they don't sort of merge very well. And I really enjoyed your talk, and I think the idea of the legal abolition of poverty is essential, particularly, as you say, for changing the ground rules. However, I feel a bit that it's quite a human rights response. And I feel that it's essential that human rights activists become what I would call development literate and really actively participate in the development discourses and the development forums that are going on, and that they actively get human rights on the agendas of poverty reduction strategies, on discussions about donor behaviour and on discussions about changes in the aid architecture. Sorry, it's more of a comment than a question, but thank you.
Hi, my name is Amjit Singh from the Law Department here. The question I have links the gentleman's question here and the lady's question over here. You seem to be placing emphasis on the legal entitlements of the poor as a vehicle for producing social change. And the literature on law and social change establishes that it does happen. In fact, the existing human rights that we already have provide the legal framework for those entitlements. Since you also have experience in the development community, my question is this. Take the example of civil rights for blacks in America. They got the vote in the 60s. They're still impoverished. They have a legal entitlement. The Supreme Court of the U.S. is an extremely strong institution. Yet they still have that problem. Clearly something else is going on. Law is part of the answer. I think you agree with that. So I'd like you to comment on what you think are the other things that will link in with law and how law can strengthen by its presence those other things. Thank you.
Hi, Jessica from LSD Development Studies. I agree that we do need to mobilise popular support behind the idea of eradicating poverty rather than reducing it. I think there is a risk, and probably is already happening, that as a result policies are developed that focus on reducing poverty headcounts rather than looking at actually targeting those that are perhaps more difficult to pull out of poverty, those that are suffering chronic poverty. And I wondered how you thought that could be dealt with and prevented.
Yeah, well, I don't have... obviously all the answers to this question. What I'm selling, and again, maybe that is where I have sometimes difficulty with lawyers, I am putting forward an emotional appeal. Now, whether technically you can qualify poverty as a human rights violation, for me, it is not an issue of law, because if the law doesn't support that, then change the law. What I'm saying is that if we are serious about eliminating poverty, we have to mobilize people, we have to put poverty on the top of the agenda, and in order to put poverty on the top of the agenda, it is not just called lawmaking, you need to mobilize in the same way as there were mobilization against apartheid, against the Vietnam War, against this, against that, and the law will respond to that. So what I'm saying, so therefore, I know that lawyers will go through the text, etc. Technically, it is not a violation, it is a denial, it is an attempt, it is this, because the word violation, etc., and violation is technically a violation of an international treaty that has been ratified, etc. Fine, as far as I'm concerned, I'm not interested in that. That is just of interest to lawyers. I am interested in making sure that people in my village, when they have kids, when you ask those kids, what do you want to become when you grow up, where here it is taken for granted that the response will be doctor or engineer or whatever, that there the answer is alive. I want to change that answer. And if that requires changing the law, we can mobilize to change the law. Now, of course, changing the law is not sufficient. I mean, law prohibits crime, but you still have criminals all over the world. And I'm talking about not human rights crime, but you know, thieves and muggers, etc. So it is not because you have a law that suddenly all the citizens in the country will be law-abiding citizens. But it is true that most citizens, the majority of the citizens, are law-abiding citizens. And when you change the law, they tend to adjust their behavior to the new law, and then a new culture develops, and then the issue becomes ensuring that the law is implemented and that those who violate the law are punished. So changing the law has to be accompanied with a continuous fight against impunity, has to be accompanied by education, and has to be accompanied by mobilization, has to be accompanied, obviously, by the resources that are invested. But when you look at the resources that are invested to tackle poverty, it is pathetic. If you compare that with the amount of money that goes to arms, that goes to perfume, that goes to dog food, that goes to... It is the amount of money that goes to poverty is pathetic. Most African countries spent three times as much money to repay debt than to invest in education and health combined. So how do you expect that they will be able to tackle seriously poverty in their respective country unless the debt issue is brought into a human rights framework and is examined from a human rights perspective in terms of its human rights impact? Right to property. I don't think this is an issue. I mean, you all pay taxes. You all pay income tax, okay? So if tomorrow the government decides to increase your income tax from, you know, 10p to the pound to 15p to the pound, there is no way you can oppose it. You cannot tell the government that you are infringing of my right to property. So if tomorrow governments in the rich countries were to decide, okay, out of the 3p to the pound, out of the 15p to the pounds you are paying, 3p will go overseas to eradicate poverty, it's not violating your right to property. I don't think it is an issue. Human rights and development, that's right. I think that is the biggest setback that the human rights agenda has faced, which is the development, the development of the development agenda. I think so. Because the human rights agenda, we can say, was born out of the new agenda, born during the war, under the leadership of Roosevelt, the Four Freedoms speech, which integrated civil and political rights and social and economic rights in that speech. And the intention was to develop one single Bill of Rights that would integrate civil and political rights, social and economic rights. And with the Cold War, newly independent countries, etc., this new agenda of development that has emerged without integrating human rights within its agenda. Development became an issue for experts and governments who had the answers without asking the people, who said in order to develop the nation we need tranquility. So development could only proceed if the prisons were full and if you had a strong leader at the helm who had the answers to everybody, working with the expert to develop the country, to develop the people. We know that that didn't work. So now the question is really how to build development on a human rights agenda, which allows to bring the individual as the center of attention of the development processes, to bring the individual as a key actor and therefore accompany development with democracy, and to ensure that the ultimate objective of development is the fulfillment of all the rights, civil and political rights, social, economic, and cultural rights, which is what the right to development is trying to do, which is what the human development indicators of UNDP is trying to do, which is the direction that the UN is going when WHO talks about fulfilling the right to health, FAO the right to food, UNESCO the right to education, et cetera. So there has been a slow reconceptualization of development from a human rights perspective. But what this departure of development from a human rights agenda has done is that you have a constituency called development NGOs and another constituency called human rights NGOs. And the human rights NGOs have tended to focus on civil and political rights. It is more, you get more response emotionally when you campaign against torture than when you campaign against poverty, because poverty is presented as a development issue, as an economic issue, and not as a human rights issue. And the challenge now is to bring this interpenetration and integration of the human rights NGO and the development NGO. It's only when they come together and they develop joint agenda and work together and take on board in an indivisible way both civil and political rights, economic, social, and cultural rights that I think they will be able to influence the overall agenda. Amnesty now has done it because Amnesty has integrated economic, social, and cultural rights on its in its mandate. It took us 10 years to change that. But it shows that things can change and move in the right direction. I think I've answered all the questions.
We've probably got time for about two more, and then must close. So,
Richard Seebohm, I used to run the Quaker office in Brussels. I think one of the important things is to remove the donor-recipient relationship if human rights are to be exercised. And you've been mentioning education a bit more in your more recent remarks. Coming from UNESCO, I do hope that the education side of teaching people that they can claim human rights will get emphasized. I think that I think that's very important, just rather than just feeding people.
MSC Human Rights. I have two questions. Do you think we should hold Western powers responsible for domestic subsidies and how they reinforce poverty? And the second question is...
Can you repeat the first question, please?
Do you think we should hold Western powers responsible for domestic subsidies and how they reinforce poverty? And the second question is, to what extent do you think fair trade policies can facilitate poverty reduction?
One last one over here.
Andreas Hansmann from the London School of Hygiene Tropical Medicine doing a course over there. Well, I'm a medical doctor. Doctors think about development and human rights, and they also have to think about population and health. Now, my problem is with this approach that population growth is expected to be about 9.1 billion population in 2050, and if we reduce poverty, we know that when you start reducing poverty, population and the people who have become richer also use more natural resources. Now there's a limited amount of natural resources available, and if everybody becomes richer, that will not last indefinitely. So certainly at some point you would have to reduce the number of people living on this earth, actually, if you want to reduce poverty at all. So I see a conflict between human rights issues here of reducing poverty and the right for sexual and reproductive health. Could you comment on that, please?
It's a difficult one to
I'm Andrew Fisher from Development Studies Institute here at LSC, and I'm just wondering, because I was interested by your comment about the flow from poor countries to rich countries instead of the inverse. because it seems that we have an international economic system whereby the most powerful country is basing its entire economic strategy over the last 10 or 20 years on these reverse flows. For instance, to finance the triple deficits, essentially, of trade, public deficit, and private deficit, which is increasing right now. And so I'm wondering, you have these incredibly entrenched interests that to maintain this reverse flow. And so I'm wondering, how would you address that? Because according to the moral principles and the actual political economy of the international system. And you know, just to give the example, the abolition of slavery in the US was achieved through a massive civil war lasting many years. Is what do we need in the international global arena to be able to achieve the same type of abolition?
The first one on the trade policies, whether subsidies and existing trade policies exacerbate poverty, I don't know. I mean, I think it is a question of research. It is for the economists to tell us what is exactly the impact of these trade policies. And you have NGOs that specialize in that, that are looking at these trade policies, that are looking at the impact, for instance, of the subsidies on cotton in the European Union or in the United States on the producers of cotton in West Africa. So there are links, but those have to be established. But in my mind, you start first by establishing that a right has been violated, and it is after that that you move back up in order to identify what have been causes or the multiple causes that have led to that state of affairs, and then you try to act at the origin of the violation. So I don't think there is, you know, a standard answer to say all trade policies have led to increase in poverty, because in some countries, like in Southeast Asia, we cannot say that the same trade policies have led to the same responses. It would depend on situations, on countries, etc., etc. Responsibility of rich countries. Well, there is a moral responsibility. It is clearly established in the various international declarations. Human rights are universal, obligations are universal. It is not because somebody is born in Nigeria that as a Nigerian citizen he should be satisfied with just enjoying half of the rights that are contained in the international instruments. It's the international community as a whole that guarantees to all the inhabitants on this planet the same rights, irrespective of where you're born, irrespective of creed, color, race, etc., etc. So yes, the responsibility is there. Now, what is the precise nature of the obligation? That is, again, for the lawyers to look at this stage, but it can change tomorrow. So, again, the law has to be seen as an instrument in order to end injustice, and not as a framework that is static, that cannot be changed, and everything has to be analyzed through that framework. Poverty and population increase. Actually, all the studies of the UN have shown that when you reduce poverty, actually, you the families that are better off end up having less children. We see it today in many societies. It is an empirical fact. The stop in population increase that you see in Europe, you see it also in other countries in the world. It is not generalized, but all those who are in the middle class have, within each country you will have to see, all those in the middle class will have less children than the poor people. So imposing on poor people to have less children than rich people, I don't think is morally tenable. And if you say if everybody has this, it is true that if everybody today had the same standard of living than, let's say, the American citizen, the world resources will not be sufficient. You will need, if my memory is correct, 60 times more resources today to have the same standard of living for everybody on this planet. So it is not sustainable. So if the objective of development is to turn us all into American consumers at that level of standard, it is clearly that this planet cannot bear it. So what is the solution? Yes, some say you have to keep people in poverty so that a few can continue to enjoy what they enjoy, and others will have to bear what they must. Or you can say, okay, this is not sustainable, so we need to maybe redistribute in order to make sure that everybody lives a decent life. Because what is the alternative? The alternative, like the question that was asked, eventually these people will take up arms. I mean, and morally, I do not find it reprehensible. I mean, when you have injustice and people who are oppressed and their rights are being denied, actually it is in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, well, they will recourse to violence. And actually you can see that violence. I mean, look at the most violent countries in the world today, Brazil, South Africa, etc. It is linked to, of course, to the history, but also it is linked to this huge inequality that exists in society. So you have all these kids, these black kids in South Africa with guns, etc. Now, they are not expressing that anger politically, but they are expressing it in criminal ways by going attacking individuals. But tomorrow they can turn their ire on the state and how the society is still not advancing quickly enough in terms of transformation of the state, of the economic structure, and of society. So I believe, because I'm a human rights believer, I believe that the answer is in human rights. I think that's the only way that we are going to solve many of these dilemmas. Otherwise, we're heading straight into the war. Now, whether it requires a civil war to get there, well, I hope not, because I think if we have that at the global level, everybody will suffer and all the destruction. Okay, and as civil rights activists, we can only use reason and passion and patience and reason with the powerful, try to show them that it is their interest, that it is their moral duty, that it is their responsibility, that they can do something about it, that it is their interest to do something about it, that it is morally reprehensible too. I believe that many political leaders all over the world are also motivated by morals. I don't think that all politicians are immorals. You have some, like in all professions, except lawyers. So you have again, it's at the political level, but I hope we can really seriously start addressing these before it is too late for many, many countries that are really rendered so fragile because of the continuous increase in poverty, and the you go to the shanty towns in Africa, in Nairobi, in Lagos, in Dakar, you have hundreds of thousands of young men who many of them have studied, but who are unemployed and who are very, very angry, very angry. So what do? They try to cross the Sahara by foot, swim the Mediterranean in order to come and find some money and some life. If they can cross the big wall that Europe has become now, or they enlist with warlords, because if you have a gun, you probably have a better life than being totally unemployed in the big shanty towns of Africa. But what option do they have? Should they just sit and die silently? These new crop of young kids that I see when I visit those places, believe me, they will not just sit and look at Abidjan, look at Cote d'Ivoire. You know, these young groups of so-called patriots, many of them students, who have been attacking white people in Cote d'Ivoire, and full of hatred, full of hatred against their own compatriots. I mean, all of that is not just because these people are, I don't know, crazy or fundamentalist, etc. They're desperate people. They have no, they cannot look at the future with any kind of hope of improvement of their life conditions whatsoever. Some of the are students who have even graduated 10 years without a job. So they tend to follow those demagogic leaders who can promise them, you know, all kinds of future. Through the use of violence. And you have hundreds of thousands of them in Africa today. Hundreds of thousands. It is very scary. And the fact that you have elections, democracy, that's fine. I mean, that is the way it should be. But that doesn't solve the problem. And the problem has to be solved. Otherwise, it is going to be... I mean, we've seen nothing. We've seen these wars in the Congo, killed 3 million people. We've seen genocide in Rwanda, has killed 800,000 people, etc., etc. But where you have population growth is precisely in countries like Africa, where the majority of the population is very young, 15 years old, where economic growth is, you know, it's not allowing the creation of jobs to occupy those kids. And if they don't have any other option, they will resort to crime, like in South Africa. They will try and emigrate by all means, by all means. You cannot imagine the number of those black kids who die trying to cross the Mediterranean every day. Every day you have corpses on the Spanish beach of these young people who are so desperate that they are ready to risk their lives in order to come to Europe. Or they will follow the warlords and destroy their own countries. But that's what the poor do. You know, when you have riots, black riots in the United States, they destroy their neighborhood. They destroy everything. I mean, so that is a real, real, real possibility, and it is very scary.
Thank you. That's a very sobering note in which to end a discussion that's ranged over law, development, trade, economics, civil society, and a host of other issues. I've just got three things that I need to do now. The first one is to say that there is a reception following this, to which you are all invited. It's in the senior common room, which is on the fifth floor of this building. So we please do see as many of you as possible. The second is that over the next few weeks, all public lectures at the LSE are taking a collection at their end for the Tsunami Disaster Emergency Committee appeal. And the Disaster Emergency Committee, as you all know, are coordinating the appeal to act in the disaster region. And we feel that lectures at the LSE are free, and that it would be an appropriate response to contribute to the appeal. Obviously, it's up to you whether you wish to do so or not.
It's not a poverty relief fund.
Precisely. It's connected in various ways. Also, that it has been told that if you wish to contribute directly, donations to the appeal can be made by visiting the website related to it, which, if anybody's interested, can give you afterwards. I suspect you can not paying well. Maybe I won't give it. www.dec.org.uk. And thirdly, and most importantly, to thank Mr. Sane very much for a very stimulating and very important lecture that he's given us.